The Red Thumb Mark by R. Austin Freeman. Part 2 of Chapter 16.
I was amused to observe the change that had come over the experts in the short interval. The confident smile, the triumphant air of laying down a trump card, had vanished, and the expression of both was one of anxiety, not unmixed with apprehension. As Mr. Singleton advanced hesitatingly to the table, I recalled the words that he had uttered in his room at Scotland Yard. Evidently, his scheme of the game that was to end in an easy checkmate had not included the move that had just been made. "Mr. Singleton," said the judge, "here is a paper on which there are 20 thumbprints. 10 of them are genuine prints of the prisoner's left thumb, and 10 are forgeries. Please examine them, and note down in writing which are the true prints and which are the forgeries. When you have made your notes, the paper will be handed to Mr. Nash."
"Is there any objection to my using the photograph that I have with me for comparison, my lord?" asked Mr. Singleton.
"I think not," replied the judge. "What do you say, Mr. Anstey?"
"No objection whatever, my lord."
Mr. Singleton accordingly drew from his pocket an enlarged photograph of the thumbprint and a magnifying glass, with the aid of which he explored the bewildering array of prints on the paper before him. And as he proceeded, I remarked with satisfaction that his expression became more and more dubious and worried. From time to time he made an entry on a memorandum slip beside him, and as the entries accumulated, his frown grew deeper, and his aspect more puzzled and gloomy. At length he sat up, and taking the memorandum slip in his hand, addressed the judge.
"I have finished my examination, my lord."
"Very well. Mr. Nash, will you kindly examine the paper and write down the results of your examination?"
"Oh, I wish they would make haste," whispered Juliet. "Do you think they will be able to tell the real from the false thumbprints?"
"I can't say," I replied, "but we shall soon know. They looked all alike to me."
Mr. Nash made his examination with exasperating deliberateness, and preserved throughout an air of stolid attention. But at length he, too, completed his notes and handed the paper back to the usher.
"Now, Mr. Singleton," said the judge, "let us hear your conclusions. You have been sworn."
Mr. Singleton stepped into the witness box and, laying his notes on the ledge, faced the judge.
"Have you examined the paper that was handed to you?" asked Sir Hector Trumpler.
"I have."
"What did you see on the paper?"
"I saw 20 thumbprints, of which some were evident forgeries, some were evidently genuine, and some were doubtful."
"Taking the thumbprints seriatim, what have you noted about them?"
Mr. Singleton examined his notes and replied,
"The thumbprint on square 1 is evidently a forgery, as is also number 2, though it is a passable imitation. 3 and 4 are genuine, 5 is an obvious forgery. 6 is a genuine thumbprint, 7 is a forgery, though a good one. 8 is genuine, 9 is, I think, a forgery, though it is a remarkably good imitation. 10 and 11 are genuine thumb marks, 12 and 13 are forgeries, but as to 14 I am very doubtful, though I am inclined to regard it as a forgery. 15 is genuine, and I think 16 is also, but I will not swear to it. 17 is certainly genuine. 18 and 19 I'm rather doubtful about, but I am disposed to consider them both forgeries. 20 is certainly a genuine thumbprint."
As Mr. Singleton's evidence proceeded, a look of surprise began to make its appearance on the judge's face, while the jury glanced from the witness to the notes before them and from their notes to one another in undisguised astonishment. As to Sir Hector Trumpler, that luminary of British jurisprudence was evidently completely fogged, for as statement followed statement, he pursed up his lips
and his broad red face became overshadowed by an expression of utter bewilderment. For a few seconds he stared blankly at his witness, and then dropped onto his seat with a thump that shook the court. "You have no doubt," said Anstey, "as to the correctness of your conclusions. For instance, you are quite sure that the prints 1 and 2 are forgeries?"
"I have no doubt."
"You swear that those two prints are forgeries?" Mr. Singleton hesitated for a moment. He had been watching the judge and the jury and had apparently misinterpreted their surprise, assuming it to be due to his own remarkable powers of discrimination, and his confidence had revived accordingly.
"Yes," he answered, "I swear that they are forgeries."
Anstey sat down, and Mr. Singleton, having passed his notes up to the judge, retired from the box, giving place to his colleague. Mr. Nash, who had listened with manifest satisfaction to the evidence, stepped into the box with all his original confidence restored. His selection of the true and the false thumbprints was practically identical with that of Mr. Singleton, and his knowledge of this fact led him to state his conclusions with an air that was authoritative and even dogmatic. "I am quite satisfied of the correctness of my statements," he said in reply to Anstey's question, "and I am prepared to swear, and do swear, that those thumbprints, which I have stated to be forgeries, are forgeries, and that their detection presents no difficulty to an observer who has an expert acquaintance with fingerprints."
"There is one question that I should like to ask," said the judge, when the expert had left the box and Thorndyke had re-entered it to continue his evidence. "The conclusions of the expert witnesses, manifestly bona fide conclusions arrived at by individual judgment, without collusion or comparison of results, are practically identical. They are virtually in complete agreement. Now, the strange thing is this. Their conclusions are wrong in every instance." Here I nearly laughed aloud, for as I glanced at the two experts, the expression of smug satisfaction on their countenances changed with lightning rapidity to a ludicrous spasm of consternation. "Not sometimes wrong and sometimes right, as would have been the case if they had made mere guesses, but wrong every time. When they are quite certain, they are quite wrong, and when they are doubtful, they incline to the wrong conclusion. This is a very strange coincidence, Dr. Thorndyke. Can you explain it?" Thorndyke's face, which throughout the proceedings had been as expressionless as that of a wooden figurehead, now relaxed into a dry smile.
"I think I can, my lord," he replied. "The object of a forger in executing a forgery is to produce deception on those who shall examine the forgery."
"Ah," said the judge,
and his face relaxed into a dry smile, while the jury broke out into unconcealed grins. "It was evident to me," continued Thorndyke, "that the experts would be unable to distinguish the real from the forged thumbprints, and that, being so, that they would look for some collateral evidence to guide them. I, therefore, supplied that collateral evidence. Now, if 10 prints are taken without special precautions from a single finger, it will probably happen that no two of them are exactly alike. For the finger, being a rounded object of which only a small part touches the paper, the impressions produced will show little variations according to the part of the finger by which the print is made. But a stamp, such as I have used, has a flat surface like that of a printer's type, and like a type, it always prints the same impression. It does not reproduce the fingertip, but a particular print of the finger, and so if 10 prints are made with a single stamp, each print will be a mechanical repetition of the other 9. Thus, on a sheet bearing 20 fingerprints, of which 10 were forgeries made with a single stamp, it would be easy to pick out the 10 forged prints by the fact that they would all be mechanical repetitions of one another, while the genuine prints could be distinguished by the fact of their presenting trifling variations in the position of the finger. Anticipating this line of reasoning, I was careful to make each print with a different stamp, and each stamp was made from a different thumbprint, and I further selected thumbprints which varied as widely as possible when I made the stamps. Moreover, when I made the real thumbprints, I was careful to put the thumb down in the same position each time, as far as I was able. And so it happened that, on the sheet submitted to the experts, the real thumbprints were nearly all alike, while the forgeries presented considerable variations. The instances in which the witnesses were quite certain were those in which I succeeded in making the genuine prints repeat one another, and the doubtful cases were those in which I partially failed.
"Thank you. That is quite clear," said the judge, with a smile of deep content such as is apt to appear on the judicial countenance when an expert witness is knocked off his pedestal. "We may now proceed, Mr. Anstey."
"You have told us," resumed Anstey, "and have submitted proofs that it is possible to forge a thumbprint so that detection is impossible. You have also stated that the thumbprint on the paper found in Mr. Hornby's safe is a forgery. Do you mean that it may be a forgery, or that it actually is one?"
"I mean that it actually is a forgery."
"When did you first come to the conclusion that it was a forgery?"
"When I saw it at Scotland Yard. There are three facts which suggested this conclusion. In the first place, the print was obviously produced with liquid blood, and yet it was a beautifully clear and distinct impression. But such an impression could not be produced with liquid blood without the use of a slab and roller, even if great care were used. And still less could it have been produced by an accidental smear. In the second place, on measuring the print with a micrometer, I found that it did not agree in dimensions with a genuine thumbprint of Reuben Hornby. It was appreciably larger. I photographed the print with the micrometer in contact, and on comparing this with a genuine thumbprint, also photographed with the same micrometer in contact, I found that the suspected print was larger by a 40th of an inch from one given point on the ridge pattern to another given point. I have here enlargements of the two photographs, in which the disagreement in size is clearly shown by the lines of the micrometer. I have also the micrometer itself and a portable microscope, if the court wishes to verify the photographs."
"Thank you," said the judge with a bland smile. "We will accept your sworn testimony unless the learned counsel for the prosecution demands verification."
He received the photographs which Thorndyke handed up, and having examined them with close attention, passed them on to the jury.
"The third fact," resumed Thorndyke, "is of much more importance, since it not only proves the print to be a forgery, but also furnishes a very distinct clue to the origin of the forgery, and so to the identity of the forger." Here the court became hushed until the silence was so profound that the ticking of the clock seemed a sensible interruption. I glanced at Walter, who sat motionless and rigid at the end of the bench, and perceived that a horrible pallor had spread over his face, while his forehead was covered with beads of perspiration.
"On looking at the print closely, I noticed at one part a minute white mark or space. It was of the shape of a capital S, and had evidently been produced by a defect in the paper, a loose fiber which had stuck to the thumb and been detached by it from the paper, leaving a blank space where it had been. But on examining the paper under a low power of the microscope, I found the surface to be perfect and intact. No loose fiber had been detached from it, for if it had,
the broken end, or at least the groove in which it had lain, would have been visible. The inference seemed to be that the loose fiber had existed, not in the paper which was found in the safe, but in the paper on which the original thumb mark had been made. Now, as far as I knew, there was only one undoubted thumbprint of Reuben Hornby's in existence, the one in the thumbograph. At my request, the thumbograph was brought to my chambers by Mrs. Hornby, and on examining the print of Reuben Hornby's left thumb, I perceived on it a minute S-shaped white space occupying a similar position to that in the red thumb mark. And when I looked at it through a powerful lens, I could clearly see the little groove in the paper in which the fiber had lain and from which it had been lifted by the inked thumb. I subsequently made a systematic comparison of the marks in the two thumbprints. I found that the dimensions of the mark were proportionally the same in each. That is to say, the mark in the thumbograph print had an extreme length of 26 one-thousandth of an inch and an extreme breadth of 14.5 one-thousandth of an inch, while that in the red thumb mark was 1/40 larger in each dimension, having an extreme length of 26.65 one-thousandth of an inch and an extreme breadth of 14.86 one-thousandth of an inch. That the shape was identical, as was shown by the superimposing tracings of greatly enlarged photographs of each mark on similar enlargements of the other, and that the mark intersected the ridges of the thumb mark in the same manner and at exactly the same parts in the two prints.
Do you say that, having regard to the facts which you have stated, it is certain that the red thumb mark is a forgery?
I do, and I also say that it is certain that the forgery was executed by means of the thumbograph.
Might not the resemblances be merely a coincidence?
No. By the law of probabilities which Mr. Singleton explained so clearly in his evidence, the adverse chances would run into untold millions. Here are two thumbprints made in different places and at different times, an interval of many weeks intervening. Each of them bears an accidental mark, which is due not to any peculiarity of the thumb, but to a peculiarity of the paper. On the theory of coincidences, it is necessary to suppose that each piece of paper had a loose fiber of exactly identical shape and size, and that this fiber came, by accident, in contact with the thumb at exactly the same spot. But such a supposition would be the more opposed to probabilities even than the supposition that two exactly similar thumbprints should have been made by different persons. And then there is the further fact that the paper found in the safe had no loose fiber to account for the mark.
What is your explanation of the presence of defibrinated blood in the safe?
It was probably used by the forger in making the thumbprint, for which purpose fresh blood would have been less suitable by reason of its clotting. He would have probably carried a small quantity in a bottle, together with the pocket slab and roller invented by Mr. Galton. It would thus be possible for him to put a drop on the slab, roll it out into a thin film, and take a clean impression with his stamp. It must be remembered that these precautions were quite necessary, since he had to make a recognizable print at the first attempt. A failure and a second trial would have destroyed the accidental appearance and might have aroused suspicion.
You have made some enlarged photographs of the thumbprints, have you not?
Yes, I have here two enlarged photographs, one of the thumbograph print and one of the red thumbprint. They both show the white mark very clearly and will assist comparison of the originals, in which the mark is plainly visible through a lens. He handed the two photographs up to the judge, together with the thumbograph, the memorandum slip, and a powerful doublet lens with which to examine them. The judge inspected the two original documents with the aid of the lens and compared them with the photographs, nodding approvingly as he made out the points of agreement.
Then he passed them on to the jury and made an entry in his notes. While this was going on, my attention was attracted by Walter Hornby. An expression of terror and wild despair had settled on his face, which was ghastly in its pallor and bedewed with sweat. He looked furtively at Thorndyke, and as I noted the murderous hate in his eyes, I recalled our midnight adventure in John Street and the mysterious cigar. Suddenly he rose to his feet, wiping his brow and steadying himself against the bench with a shaking hand. Then he walked quietly to the door and went out. Apparently I was not the only onlooker who had been interested in his doings, for as the door swung to after him, Superintendent Miller rose from his seat and went out by the other door.
"Are you cross-examining this witness?" the judge inquired, glancing at Sir Hector Trumpler.
"No, my lord," was the reply.
"Are you calling any more witnesses, Mr. Anstey?"
"Only one, my lord," replied Anstey.
"The prisoner, whom I shall put in the witness box as a matter of form, in order that he may make a statement on oath."
Reuben was accordingly conducted from the dock to the witness box, and having been sworn, made a solemn declaration of his innocence. A brief cross-examination followed, in which nothing was elicited, but that Reuben had spent the evening at his club and gone home to his rooms at about 11:30, and had let himself in with his latchkey. Sir Hector at length sat down. The prisoner was led back to the dock, and the court settled itself to listen to the speeches of the counsel.
"My lord and gentlemen of the jury," Anstey commenced in his clear, mellow tones, "I do not propose to occupy your time with a long speech. The evidence that has been laid before you is at once so intelligible, so lucid, and so conclusive, that you will, no doubt, arrive at your verdict, uninfluenced by any display of rhetoric, either on my part or on the part of the learned counsel for the prosecution. Nevertheless, it is desirable to disentangle from the mass of evidence those facts which are really vital and crucial. Now, the one fact which stands out and dominates the whole case is this. The prisoner's connection with this case rests solely upon the police theory of the infallibility of fingerprints. Apart from the evidence of the thumbprint, there is not, and there never was, the faintest breath of suspicion against him. You have heard him described as a man of unsullied honor, as a man whose character is above reproach, a man who is trusted implicitly by those who have had dealings with him. And this character was not given by a casual stranger, but by one who has known him from childhood. His record is an unbroken record of honorable conduct. His life has been that of a clean-living, straightforward gentleman. And now he stands before you, charged with a miserable, paltry theft, charged with having robbed that generous friend, the brother of his own father, the guardian of his childhood, and the benefactor who has planned and striven for his well-being. Charged, in short, gentlemen, with a crime which every circumstance connected with him and every trait of his known character renders utterly inconceivable. Now, upon what grounds has this gentleman of irreproachable character been charged with this mean and sordid crime? Baldly stated, the grounds of the accusation are these. A certain learned and eminent man of science has made a statement, which the police have not merely accepted, but have, in practice,
extended beyond its original meaning. That statement is as follows. A complete or nearly complete accordance between two prints of a single finger affords evidence requiring no corroboration that the persons from whom they were made are the same. That statement, gentlemen, is in the highest degree misleading and ought not to have been made without due warning and qualification. So far is it from being true in practice that its exact contrary is the fact. The evidence of a fingerprint in the absence of corroboration is absolutely worthless. Of all forms of forgery, the forgery of a fingerprint is the easiest and most secure, as you have seen in this court today. Consider the character of the high-class forger, his skill, his ingenuity, his resource. Think of the forged banknotes, of which not only the engraving, the design, and the signature, but even the very paper with its private watermarks is imitated with a perfection that is at once the admiration and the despair of those who have to distinguish the true from the false. Think of the forged check, in which actual perforations are filled up, of which portions are cut out bodily and replaced by indistinguishable patches. Think of these, and then of a fingerprint, of which any photo engraver's apprentice can make you a forgery that the greatest experts cannot distinguish from the original, which any capable amateur can imitate beyond detection after a month's practice. And then ask yourselves if this is the kind of evidence on which, without any support or corroboration, a gentleman of honor and position should be dragged before a criminal court and charged with having committed a crime of the basest and most sordid type. But I must not detain you with unnecessary appeals. I will remind you briefly of the salient fact. The case for the prosecution rests upon the assertion that the thumbprint found in the safe was made by the thumb of the prisoner. If that thumbprint was not made by the prisoner, there is not only no case against him, but no suspicion of any kind. Now, was that thumbprint made by the prisoner's thumb? You have had conclusive evidence that it was not. That thumbprint differed in the size or scale of the pattern from a genuine thumbprint of the prisoner's. The difference was small, but it was fatal to the police theory. The two prints were not identical. But if not the prisoner's thumbprint, what was it? The resemblance of the pattern was too exact for it to be the thumbprint of another person, for it reproduced not only the pattern of the ridges of the prisoner's thumb, but also the scar of an old wound. The answer that I propose to this question is that it was an intentional imitation of the prisoner's thumbprint, made with the purpose of fixing suspicion on the prisoner, and so ensuring the safety of the actual criminal. Are there any facts which support this theory? Yes, there are several facts which support it very strongly. First, there are the facts that I have just mentioned. The red thumbprint disagreed with the genuine print in its scale or dimensions. It was not the prisoner's thumbprint, but neither was it that of any other person.
The only alternative is that it was a forgery. In the second place, that print was evidently made with the aid of certain appliances and materials. And one of those materials, namely defibrinated blood, was found in the safe. In the third place, there is the coincidence that the print was one which it was possible to forge. The prisoner has 10 digits, 8 fingers, and 2 thumbs. But there were in existence actual prints of the 2 thumbs, whereas no prints of the fingers were in existence. Hence, it would have been impossible to forge a print of any of the fingers. So it happens that the red thumbprint resembled one of the 2 prints of which forgery was possible. In the fourth place, the red thumbprint reproduces an accidental peculiarity of the thumbograph prints. Now, if the red thumbprint is a forgery, it must have been made from the thumbograph print, since there exists no other print from which it could have been made. Hence we have the striking fact that the red thumbprint is an exact replica, including accidental peculiarities, of the only print from which a forgery could have been made. The accidental S-shaped mark in the thumbograph print is accounted for by the condition of the paper. The occurrence of the mark in the red thumbprint is not accounted for by any peculiarity of the paper, and can be accounted for in no way except by assuming the one to be a copy of the other. The conclusion is thus inevitable that the red thumbprint is a photomechanical reproduction of the thumbograph print. But there is yet another point. If the red thumbprint is a forgery reproduced from the thumbograph print, the forger must at some time have had access to the thumbograph. Now you have heard Mrs. Hornby's remarkable story of the mysterious disappearance of the thumbograph and its still more mysterious reappearance. That story can have left no doubt in your minds that some person had surreptitiously removed the thumbograph and, after an unknown interval, secretly replaced it. Thus the theory of forgery receives confirmation at every point and is in agreement with every known fact, whereas the theory that the red thumbprint was a genuine thumbprint is based upon a gratuitous assumption and has not had a single fact advanced in its support. Accordingly, gentlemen, I assert that the prisoner's innocence has been proved in the most complete and convincing manner, and I ask you for a verdict in accordance with that proof.
End of part 2 of chapter 16.